Okay, good morning, everybody. I haven't seen some of you because you weren't in lab, if you didn't have lab this morning. But anyway, good morning. This is April 29th, and we're going to finish up the vascular chapter, move into the lymphatic chapter. And I'm just going to turn a couple of these lights off. I think I'm going to do any drawing on the board today. That one I want on. That one I want off. Okay. Okay, let's look on the right-hand side. That's our schedule. So today is indeed the 29th. Yes, we're going to get into lymphatic system. That's a Wednesday. So let's see where we are. In 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks from today, get your surfboards out. That's going to be the last day, and then you'll be able to hit the beach for the summer. On that last day, we do have an exam. And here are the chapters, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. What chapter are we on? We're on 21. So we still got a couple chapters, but we got 3 weeks to cover all those chapters. That's fine. We're looking good. Also, on that last week, the Monday class gets a practicum, and then the Wednesday class, which are the people that have lab today, they'll have a lecture exam and a practicum. Fortunately, the information is very similar. The lab should help you understand the lecture chapters. Right, so that's the plan with that. But you still have to make sure you get plenty of sleep the night before because it might be a long day for some of you that have a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day. There will not be a lab on that last day, so the 8 o'clock class, we're not going to have that practicum at 8, probably more at 9 or 9:30 because it's just not going to take very long to get that practicum out of the way, so no sense being there at first thing in the morning. But you're welcome to come and sit there and study and ask me questions if you want, if need be, or go into that study room. And then the afternoon class, you'll take the practicum pretty much right away, and then after the practicum is done on Wednesday, that's pretty much the end of the class for you. Ah, except that's a Wednesday, which means, however, you might have an online assignment that's due Thursday after that. All right, so if you don't work ahead and get that done, then the deadline for that is on the 21st. So I won't be putting any final grades together until probably Friday because of that online assignment. But you'll get your lecture exams, I'm sure, well before that, and the practicum graded well before that. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule at all? We're good on that schedule? I'm glad. All right, so let's finish up vascular system. I'm not sure exactly where we are, so let's take a look at vascular system. All right, we looked at the different layers of the heart, of the blood vessels. And just like the heart has layers, vessels have layers, but the heart only has three. Vessels have four layers except for a capillary. It only has one. Okay, we talked about the pulmonary circulation. And I think probably I want to pull up a figure and see if I can't trick you into saying something. All right, so here is a typical circulatory pattern. You have a blood vessel that is taking blood away from the heart, and on this particular diagram, I see it colored red, and then it feeds a bunch of smaller blood vessels, and then it even enters into a network of really tiny small vessels. All right, so these are capillaries, and then after blood flows through a capillary, it returns to a heart via a vein. All right, so blood flow away from the heart is carried via an artery. Blood flow toward the back to the heart is carried by a vein. That's the definition. All right, but what does this red color mean? What does the red color mean in this particular? High in oxygen, that's right. And then over here in this vein is blue, which means? Low in oxygen. So if it's high in oxygen here, low in oxygen over here, what's happening in these capillaries? What's happening in these capillaries? Exchange, that's right. So oxygen is leaving, moving into the tissues. CO2 that's in the tissues is moving into the blood. And it's going to eventually get to the lungs to where you'll exhale it out of your body. All right, so don't forget, capillaries is exchange. So this is the typical, the usual kind of circulatory system. I don't want to give a percentage, but you can maybe think like 99.9% of the time, this is what a circulatory system looks like. You have the heart and one artery, one capillary, one vein, then back to the heart. There are some exceptions to that rule that we're going to look at, I think, next. What's going on here? Looks weird. Okay. All right, so when we look, let's go back to that illustration. When we look at the illustration, you should be able to tell me what circulation this is. And I want to make sure you're tracking with me. Start with, how many sides does the heart have?
Two.
It's got a right and left. So how many major circulations are there in the body? There are two, and they are pulmonary and systemic. So those are your two choices, pulmonary or systemic. Which one do we see on this illustration, pulmonary or systemic? And there's absolutely a way you can tell. Okay, a lot of people are thinking, I'm glad you're thinking. Okay, because here is a blood vessel carrying blood away from the heart and it's red, meaning high in oxygen. Which circulation, pulmonary or systemic, has arteries that are high in oxygen? Yeah, it's systemic, right? So these are arteries, capillaries, and veins in the systemic circulation. Right, so that now I'm ready to try to trick you. All right, I'm going to try to trick you by pulling up this particular figure. That's not quite it. I don't see it. Talk about it. Ah, this is the figure I'm looking for. All right, so here I see CO2 leaving the blood, oxygen entering. So what is this process called? Exchange. And where does it happen? It's not, it is labeled a capillary, right? Remember, capillaries have very thin walls that allow for exchange. All right, so I diverted you a little bit. So here I see a blood vessel, and it's blue. I'm pointing to a blue blood vessel. Somebody should name this blood vessel for me. It's pulmonary. I like pulmonary. What else? Artery or vein. Okay, and you got to take a stand, because if you make a mistake now, that's okay. But you got to get over making a mistake on that. And it's tough sometimes. All right, so I have it on a blue blood vessel in the lungs. What kind of vessel in the lungs is low in oxygen? An artery or a vein? It's the artery, right? So this blue thing right here is a pulmonary artery. And what is this red vessel? It's a pulmonary vein, right? So the pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation are going to be opposite in terms of their physiology, what kind of blood they are carrying, right? High oxygen in systemic arteries, high oxygen in pulmonary veins. And I'm sure you're probably even going to get a question on this on a practicum, right? Because pulmonary system will be on the lab coming up. So if there is an arrow, let's put an arrow right here. What kind of vessel would you call this, where the arrow is right now? Pulmonary, I like. Pulmonary what?
Vein.
Pulmonary vein. That's right, because it's red, right? All right, so don't get tricked with that. And if you were tricked today, then you're going to probably, I would say, you should probably come see me again a couple more times, and I'll try and trick you some more so that it becomes obvious, right? It's just one of those things that sometimes it takes a little while for you to see. All right. I think we talked about all these different kinds of blood vessels. You know, I don't remember talking about this abdominal aorta, but maybe we did. We didn't talk about that? Okay. Branches off the aorta. Right. We started talking about systemic circulation, right? Okay, branches off the aorta. Yeah, we did the upper limbs. Upper limbs, you want to start right there? Okay, let's take a look at what's going on right there. And this is going to help you directly in lab as well. So here is a large figure with all these vessels that we want to talk about. And I'm going to have to zoom in. And unfortunately, I'm going to lose our nice cursor when we do that, but that's the way it goes. All right, so here we have the heart. And I see a bunch of red vessels taking blood away from the heart. So what circulation are we looking at? Systemic, right? Systemic, because these are all arteries high in oxygen. All right. And I see a great vessel coming off the base of the heart, and it is called the first one, systemic, is the aorta. Aorta's got a number of pieces. This first piece, which is moving superiorly, is called the ascending aorta. There are some important branches off the ascending aorta that we're going to get to in just a second. And then after the ascending, we have the arch of the aorta. Let's really zoom in. Arch of the aorta, and you can see some blood vessels coming off the arch as well. And then we have the descending aorta. It goes behind the heart, so we can't see it when it's in the thoracic cavity, that would be called the thoracic division of the descending aorta. It goes through the diaphragm, and then what cavity is it in when it goes through the diaphragm?
Abdominal.
So here is the abdominal division of the descending aorta, and then it's going to split into two, no longer becoming the aorta. It is called the iliac, right? Common iliac arteries. All right, so let's go back. Here's another little tricky thing. I see some arteries on the surface of the heart that are colored red. All right, so do these belong to the systemic or pulmonary circulation? Take a look at this. Here's an artery underneath this clavicle. It's red. You told me it belonged to the systemic circulation. What about this artery over here on the heart that's red? It has to be part of the systemic circulation as well, right? All red arteries are going to be part of the systemic circulation. So these arteries feed oxygen to the heart, get rid of CO2 that's in the heart, and some other important metabolites. And these, what do we call these arteries that nourish the heart? They got a certain class. All right, we said systemic, and that's right, but there's like a subclass of these nice systemic arteries on the heart. They are called coronary arteries, right? Coronary arteries are arteries that feed the heart. And maybe you should know, certainly if you've had lab, you should know how many there are. How many are there? There are two. Right, so here is the left coronary, here is the right coronary artery. There are only two. And they come off of the ascending aorta, right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve. Okay, so I don't really see it right here, but what are the first branches off the aorta? It's another kind of tricky question. What are the first branches of arteries off the aorta? I see brachiocephalic. I like that. Brachiocephalic is here, right? That's on the arch, but you know what? I want you to tell me of the whole aorta, not just the arch, of the whole aorta, which are the first branches coming off? Okay, the left coronary artery and the right coronary artery, because they come off the aorta in the ascending division, which comes before the aortic arch. See what I mean? So the first one on the aorta is not the brachiocephalic, but it's these two coronaries that are in the ascending aorta. And this diagram just can barely show them to you. But if I ask you, what's the first branch off the arch of the aorta, then you're going to yell out right away, brachiocephalic. Yeah. Okay, and then there's two more, so we lose a little bit of symmetry. The next branch off the arch is the left common carotid going to the head and the left subclavian, right, because we can see it going underneath the clavicle. And then we can see that this brachiocephalic is taking, that goes to the right side of the body, is taking blood to the right side of the head and the right upper appendage. So the brachiocephalic is doing the job of the left common carotid and left subclavian. Right, it just kind of separated out just the way it is. Okay. All right, so we got subclavian, same blood vessel, right, courses through the axilla. Its name becomes the, what does it become? Subclavian becomes the axillary artery, all right, and then it's the same tube that goes into the arm. We call that the brachial artery. And so that might seem a little confusing, but you know what? When you drive around different streets, like if you hop on Lincoln and drive to Long Beach, they change the name on you, right? What does it become in Long Beach? It becomes Carson Street, right? So we're kind of familiar with that already. This is the same tube, but it has different names depending on what region of the body that it's in, and that makes perfect sense. Okay, so then the brachial, right, is going to bifurcate. Which ones do we want to know about that? Okay, brachial into these two right here, and you got to remember your skeletal anatomy and your anatomic position. So here's a thumb sticking laterally. So what bone in the forearm matches up with the thumb? It is the radius, and then over here's the ulna. So here's the radial artery, and here's the ulnar artery, and you can count somebody's heart rate. You can take somebody's pulse very easily by palpating with your fingers, not your thumb, but your fingertips on the radial artery. So guess what? Maybe some people have been calling that the radial pulse the whole time, and you're wondering, gee whiz, what the heck does that radial pulse mean? I don't see a wheel or an axle or anything, right? Radial just refers to the bone, the radius, which is what names the artery that's right over there. Very superficial, so that you can palpate it. And then I see some nice palmar arches as well. And so that's what we want you to know about the upper limbs. Thoracic aorta, there are visceral arteries that feed organs like the lungs, besides the pulmonary circulation, and parietal arteries that feed muscles of the chest wall like internal, external, intercostals. I'm not going to show you those. We're going to move right down to the abdominal aorta. So here is a pretty good illustration of abdominal aorta, but maybe I have a better one, one that's kind of zoomed in. Abdominal aorta, how about this one here? Pretty good. Did you get lost when I did this, when I switched over? Not too bad, right? Here's the diaphragm, and here is the abdominal division of the descending aorta. Okay, so it looks a little complicated, but let's kind of, if you have something complicated, break it down into its pieces. And the two pieces that I want you to see here are the kinds of blood vessels that come off the aorta. There are some blood vessels that are always what we call paired branches. They go to organs that you have two of a kind, right? So here you have a kidney. You got a kidney on the right, a kidney on the left. They each have their own artery. We call this a paired branch. These are the renal arteries. And we also have some arteries that go to an organ that you only have one of. And we haven't studied these very well because we haven't been to the digestive system yet, but can anybody think of some organs in your abdominal or pelvic cavity that you only have one of? Spleen, I like that. The stomach, right? The liver, you only have one of. And so there's only one branch coming from the aorta to feed those organs, and they come from this one right here that's called the celiac trunk. So celiac is an unpaired branch, and as a matter of fact, that's the first branch off of the abdominal aorta, celiac trunk. And there is a piece that goes to the stomach, a piece that goes to the spleen, right? The one that goes to the stomach is the gastric artery. I don't think it's even labeled on this illustration. I don't think in lab that you have to know that, but a trunk just means that it will feed numerous arteries, like the gastric to the stomach, the splenic to the spleen, the hepatic artery. Where does the hepatic artery go? To the liver. Yeah, anytime you hear that word hepo or hepo, you should think of liver. All right, so you only have one of those organs, so that's a single branch. All right, here are the kidneys, and on top of the kidneys, we have some adrenal glands. You got one on the left, one on the right. What kind of branch is going to come off the aorta for the two adrenal glands? Single or paired? Got to be paired. All right, so here are the two paired suprarenal arteries or adrenal arteries. Usually we call these suprarenal arteries. Okay, a paired branch. Then we got the renal arteries going to the kidneys. And then I see two more. These are kind of in a really funny spot. I see two ones that are smaller than the kidneys arteries. And these go all the way down into the pelvic cavity, right? And maybe even sometimes all the way down into the scrotum. And these are arteries that bring blood to gonads. What the heck is a gonad? Gonad is a general term for either a testes or an ovary, right? So depending on what your gender is, you have some of those structures. All right, so here are the gonadal arteries. Since you have two gonads, it's a paired branch. All right, so that's it for the paired branches, renal, gonadal, suprarenal, right? Just three, that's not too bad. And what about unpaired branches? I want you to know three. The first one is celiac trunk. The second one is superior mesenteric. This goes to small intestine. And mesentery just means some tissue around the intestines and is loaded with blood vessels and loaded with capillaries for exchange, right? It absorbs nutrients. So here's a superior mesenteric. And you see another unpaired branch on the aorta. All the way down here. Yeah, exactly. The inferior mesenteric. This brings blood to some of the small intestine and large intestine, okay? Because you only have one large intestine, only one small intestine. All right, so break this down into paired and unpaired, and I think it will be pretty trivial for you to appreciate what's happening there. Okay, so let's move down past the aorta, right? This bifurcation then produces a right and left common iliac artery. So let's zoom in. Let's see what we can do. This probably is pretty good. What about this one here? Okay, good enough. All right, so here is part of the abdominal division of the aorta. It bifurcates into the right and left common iliac, and then it courses down into the pelvic cavity, and I see another bifurcation, And let's zoom into it. Another bifurcation. Here is the external iliac. Here is the internal iliac. So this is common because it's going to give origin to the external and internal iliac. When the iliac moves close to the head of the femur, then it becomes the femoral artery. So again, it's the same tube, just a different name because it's in a little bit different region of the body. We have a deep femoral. I'm not so sure that that's on your list to know of anything. No, that's not, you're not responsible for that. And the last artery that you're responsible for, the femoral, goes behind the knee, posterior to the knee. Kind of looks like it's behind the kneecap right here, behind the patella, but actually it's behind the whole knee joint. That is the popliteal artery. Popliteal is behind the knee. And you're going to see that in lab pretty nicely. All right, so the lower appendage is pretty easy. And we're done looking at those blood vessels. Veins. Right, veins are going to be blue, so I'm going to go to some blue. If it's a systemic circulation, it's going to be blue. So here is our blue man. And one nice thing about veins is that usually veins are named similarly to arteries. Right, so if you have a femoral artery, you also have a femoral vein in that same part of the body. If you have an axillary artery, you have an axillary vein in that same part of the body. There's only a couple cases where things change a little bit. All right, well, remember, for arteries, arteries that bring blood to the brain are called carotids. And we don't have a carotid vein. Instead, those veins are called jugular veins. All right, so here we have the internal jugular, external jugular. They bring blood really close to the heart. They empty blood into a vessel that goes underneath the clavicle or the subclavian vein. Right, you had a subclavian artery. Right, when the subclavian vein joins with the jugular vein, then it becomes a brachiocephalic, right? Because jugular is from the head, subclavian is from the arm. Brachio means arm, cephalic means head. Right, so here is a bit of a brachiocephalic, just about right exactly where my cursor is. That's the extent. And what side of the body is that on? You got to think, right or left, right or left. Yeah, you're looking at some anterior picture of somebody, so this is the right brachiocephalic vein. Right, and I want to jump away from veins for a second and think about arteries. Did you have to know a brachiocephalic artery of some kind or another? Did we ever talk about that? Yeah, how many were there? One. Yeah, there was only one brachiocephalic artery, and where would you look for it? How would you describe somebody where to find that brachiocephalic artery? Yeah, it's the first branch off the aorta, right? And so there's only one of them. And so we don't have to say right or left brachiocephalic artery because there is only one. Now, over here for a vein, guess what? We have two brachiocephalics. The first one is this little small segment on the right side of the body. Now let's look on the left side of the body. Here's that jugular. Here's the subclavian. When they join together or anastomose, then it becomes a brachiocephalic vein, and it's a much longer segment on the left side of the body. So this you have to call the left brachiocephalic vein. So do you see that there's a big difference between left and right brachiocephalic vein? Yeah, if you tell somebody right brachiocephalic vein and it's really left, you're not helping that patient out because there's two of them, right? Okay, but how many brachiocephalic arteries are there? Only one, yeah. Okay, and then the brachiocephalics will anastomose to make the superior vena cava. Right, so we could go backwards a little bit. We got superior vena cava, brachiocephalic, jugular, subclavian, right? So we just went backwards of what we were talking about. Also on this illustration, I can see another big cavernous vein underneath the heart, inferior to the heart, and that is the inferior vena cava, right? So here's superior and inferior vena cava. All right, so that's something that's a little bit different. Okay, and in lab, we go over some of these other blood vessels, right? Like a cephalic, a basilic, okay, and brachial veins. So I don't think I'm going to talk much about that. And even for these veins down over here, you got iliac, common iliac, right, internal iliac vein. So So these are very, very similar to the arteries that we've looked at so far. So there's one other interesting area, okay, and that's in the head. Let me see if I can find some arteries in the head. Oh, I didn't even talk about some arteries in the head. I want to talk about some arteries in the head. All right, so here's the arch, right? We have the arch of the aorta. Here's that first branch off the arch of the aorta. You're familiar with this. This is the first branch off the arch is the brachiocephalic, right? Brachiocephalic means toward the arm via the subclavian or head via the common carotid. And is that what we see? Ah, yeah, that's exactly what we see, right? And the first branch off the subclavian, we showed you this last time. It goes through all those transverse foramina in the cervical vertebrae. And so that's the vertebral artery. And the first branch off the brachiocephalic is the common carotid. We call that a common carotid because it's going to bifurcate into an internal and an external carotid artery. Internal goes into the brain. External goes to every place outside the skull. Right. So here are two arteries, and I think it's mentioned on your slide with some asterisks. The vertebral artery and carotid artery are the only two arteries that bring blood to the brain. And if we shut off blood to the carotid and vertebrals, what can you tell me about your conscious state? If we cut off blood, what's going to happen to your conscious state? What's going to happen to consciousness? It's going to disappear. How long will that take after we stop blood flow? Yeah, about 2 seconds, right? 2 to 3 seconds. And if that blood flow isn't restored, when does the brain actually die? Yeah, about 2 minutes, right? So that's how important these blood vessels are, and you only have two of them, right, on one side of the body. You got an internal carotid and a vertebral performing that really important function. Okay. Well, let me look at this next picture here. So here we're looking at the ventral side of the brain. So why is it okay that we only have four blood vessels feeding everywhere in the brain? Well, because there is a plexus. Does anybody remember a nerve plexus? What does a nerve plexus look like? It looks like a network. Why is there a nerve plexus, or one of the reasons why there's a nerve plexus? Alternate routes, that's right. So if one nerve gets damaged because of that plexus, nerve impulses can take different routes to get to and innervate an important organ. All right, now what about the brain? An important organ? Yes. Needs blood? Yes. All right, so I would expect to see some kind of plexus in the brain, but in terms of the vascular system. So let's check this out. So here are the two vertebral arteries, right, going through the transverse foramina. So that's two arteries. The other two, we said what, were the internal carotids. Here are the internal carotids, here and here. Right. Is it labeled? Yeah, internal carotid. Those are the only four arteries that bring blood to this whole brain over here, both the right and left side. These vertebral arteries anastomose and form the basilar artery right underneath the pons. And now we get to an interesting structure. Do you see something that looks like a circle here? Okay. That used to be called the circle of Willis. And, oh yeah, that's really nice. And so now it's just called the cerebral arterial circle. I'm not sure anybody would know what you're talking about if you call it the cerebral arterial circle. You should probably just call it the circle of Willis. And so what makes up the circle? Where does the circle of Willis get blood? From both vertebrals and both common carotids. And when blood gets into the circle of Willis, right, it can go anywhere in the brain. For instance, if the right internal carotid becomes occluded, what about this right side of the brain? Where can it get blood from? The left internal carotid and both vertebrals, because blood can take an alternate route to get over to this middle cerebral artery. All right, so this is a very important vascular plexus, and people usually don't have trouble until there's major blockage in more than one of these arteries. All right, so imaging will tell, well, there's a 40% blockage in this internal and a 30% over here. That might start to cause some problems. Okay? Or a 30% blockage of this basilar artery, that probably won't cause any problems because you have these normal carotid arteries doing just fine. So what are the pieces of this circle of Willis that I think that I would like for you to know? Okay, basilar coming from the vertebral, and we have a anterior communicating artery that is between the anterior cerebral arteries that branch off of the internal carotid. And then here we have a posterior communicating artery. So you've got a posterior communicating, anterior communicating, and this anterior cerebral artery. And that forms the circle of Willis, and that protects your brain very nicely. Do you see how you can take alternate routes around and around and around to get blood to all those important places of your brain? So that's the arterial system. The other thing that I would really like to show you, okay, are back to the venous system. Okay, I think this is an exam figure. So here we have internal jugular. Can anybody tell me where this internal jugular vein goes? It's bringing blood to another blood vessel. It's going to bring blood to a, okay, it's going to join with a subclavian to form a brachiocephalic, right? It's going to join with a subclavian to make a brachiocephalic. So where's this jugular getting blood from? Well, here is the superior sagittal sinus, and it's a vein, right? Right midsection of the brain, superior part of the brain. This is where cerebral spinal fluid empties into as well, right through those arachnoid granulations. Then blood flows back down, posterior part of the brain, and we have a confluence of sinuses. What kind of sinuses join right here? Right, besides the superior sagittal sinus, we have a straight sinus, and we have a transverse sinus joining. After they all join together, okay, then that becomes the sigmoid sinus, and the sigmoid sinus eventually drains into the jugular. Right, so all of these are sinuses inside the brain. They're not really considered veins. They're just big pockets where blood drains from the brain and eventually drains into the jugular, and then that meets up with the subclavian someplace to make a brachiocephalic vein. So these structures are a little bit different compared to that carotid artery and vertebral artery. So these are the dural venous sinuses of the brain. They're within the dura, right, or the meninges. All right, so now I'm done talking about some general circulations. What is a general circulatory pattern or architecture that we normally see? What can we say about the usual kind of circulatory pattern that we see is, how many arteries?
One
artery. How many veins? One vein. How many capillary beds? One. Right, so one artery takes blood away from the heart, that takes it to a capillary for exchange, and after that first capillary, blood flows into a vein, taking it back to the heart. So you got one artery, one capillary, one vein. There are a couple places in your body where you don't have just one capillary. You have actually two capillaries back to back, and that's what we call a portal system. And there are a couple important portal systems. Well, they're very important, right, because they're just so weird, so special. Here is a portal system. I'll give you some specific examples where we find portal systems. Right, but can you tell that this is different compared to that previous illustration that I showed you? Here is one artery. Here is a capillary bed for exchange. Right, can you see exchange taking place? And, for instance, let's put this capillary in a stomach or small intestine. And this capillary is going to be picking up whatever in that stomach and intestine, anything that you've eaten, nutrients as well as toxins. What's your favorite toxin or intoxicant? Probably ethyl alcohol, adult beverage, right? Don't have to be so ashamed of that. All right, so toxins are absorbed by these capillaries in your intestines, right? And if those toxins were dumped into your circulatory system, then you would have big problems. You might not have any brain function, right? But those toxins are not taken to your brain, right? They're taken to the liver. So here is the first capillary bed from these organs that are absorbing whatever in your digestive tract. They join together or anastomose to form something that looks a lot like a vein, but this vein doesn't take blood to the heart, it takes it to the liver. And here is a second capillary bed, and these toxins then can diffuse out of the blood, and the liver detoxifies, it gets rid of those toxins, a whole different kinds of processes where that can happen. And then after the second capillary bed, then blood enters the regular hepatic vein, that goes into the inferior vena cava that goes back to the heart. So this portal system has two capillary beds back to back, and I think what you should appreciate that this is a door-to-door delivery system, right, without having to enter all the other places in your body. And this vessel that joins the two capillary beds, that's what we call a portal vein, and since it's in the liver, we call that the hepatic portal vein. So what do we have in the text slide? Well, basically the same thing, but it's just kind of a concept map. It's not a really pretty picture. Right, so we have the gastrointestinal tract where we have capillaries that absorb nutrients and toxins, and these things empty into the gastric vein, superior mesenteric vein, inferior mesenteric vein, splenic vein. All of these veins empty into the hepatic portal vein. So all of these things up over here, capillary bed number one, the portal vein takes it to the second capillary bed, right? So, and that's in the liver. Capillary bed number two, and then after through that second capillary bed into hepatic veins, inferior vena cava, then back, not shown on the slide because I haven't scrolled down, inferior vena cava, where does blood go then? Right atrium, right? So we did that last time, we drew all, trace a drop of blood through the circulatory system. Make sure you can do that for the test. Okay. Fetal circulation, we're going to do that in lab. So I'm not going to talk about that in lecture. Except maybe one thing. One thing is good, just generally speaking. Okay. How many sides does the heart have, once again?
Two.
The right and left. How many major circulations are there?
Two.
There are two. Go ahead, tell me their names. Systemic and pulmonary, or pulmonary and systemic. Maybe pulmonary and systemic is a good way to think of it. Okay. All right. Now in the... And the pulmonary circulation goes to the lungs, and we're breathing in and out so that we can get exchange of gases, like we want to bring oxygen into our body and get rid of CO2. But a fetus, remember, is just a person that hasn't been born, right? So it's just a person in utero. Do they have air to breathe? No, right? So they don't really use their lungs for gas exchange. As a matter of fact, they hardly use their lungs at all. So they don't need to have a lot of blood going to the lungs because they're suspended in amniotic fluid, and blood going to the lungs would just be a waste of energy. So the fetal circulation, right, is going to do the job of the pulmonary circulation. So instead of blood going to the lungs in a fetus, where does blood go to in a fetus to get oxygen and nutrients and to get rid of waste products? The placenta, right? So in your mind, I want you to think of the placenta as like being the lung for the fetus, okay? And so you can just tell me, for a pulmonary artery, what color is a pulmonary artery? Pulmonary artery. I tried to trick you. I tricked you a bunch of times already. It's blue, right? Pulmonary artery is blue, and pulmonary veins are red. Now, we said that the placental circulation should be thought of like the pulmonary, and we call it the umbilical system. There's an umbilical artery, umbilical vein. So if you have a blue vessel that's part of the umbilical circulation, is that going to be an artery or a vein?
Artery.
A blue pulmonary vessel is an artery. A blue umbilical vessel is also an artery because the placenta should be thought of as like a lung for the fetus, right? And what about a red umbilical vessel? It's the umbilical vein, right? Because blood is going to the placenta, pick up oxygen, and when it picks up oxygen, it becomes red, and it's returned back to the fetal circulation, right? So umbilical veins are red, umbilical arteries are blue, just like in the pulmonary circulation. Okay, I didn't show you any pretty pictures of that, but hopefully you can have a nice picture of that in your mind. All right, so that's it for circulatory system. Okay. All right. Any questions? Questions on that? I don't see any questions. Okay. So we finished up with that. Okay, what chapter's next? I believe it's chapter 20. which is lymphatic system. 21? Chapter 21. Ah, they reordered the chapters. Okay. Chapter 21. Well, we've been talking about the cardiovascular system. Cardiovascular system has three main components to it. What are the three main components of the cardiovascular system? The heart. I like that. Heart, number one. Blood vessels, number two. That means we need one more component. It is the lymphatic system, right? Part of the cardiovascular system. All right, so through the heart and blood vessels, we have blood. Through the lymphatic system, there is a fluid that moves through the lymphatic system, but it's not exactly like blood. It's going to be something similar to blood. And I can't remember if we talked about this or not, but if you have blood, regular blood that we take right out of somebody, it's got two main components to it. And I don't think we talked about this, but I want to talk about it just a little bit. What are the two main components that we find in blood? We could separate blood into two main types of tissues. We got red blood cells, that's right. And then we have the fluid part. What's the fluid part called? Plasma, that's right. So in blood, we have things that we call formed elements, including red blood cells and a few white blood cells, a few platelets, but those are all formed elements. And then we have the fluid part, which is plasma. And lymph is going to be a lot like plasma. It shouldn't have any red blood cells in it, very few white blood cells if this is a healthy person. So you have a fluid in the lymphatic system, and lymph you should think of as plasma, just the one little component that's in your arteries and veins. Okay. So what's the composition of the lymphatic system? Well, it's lymph. And what is lymph like? Lymph is like a lot of, it's very similar to blood plasma, right? We have lymphocytes. I think we've talked about lymphocytes. As a matter of fact, you had to identify one on a practicum one time, right? It's a white blood cell. It's there to fight infection, part of your immune response. We have lymph vessels, which carry lymph back to the heart. So a lymph vessel is a lot like what, an artery or a vein? A lot like a vein. Yeah, it's a lot like a vein. You have lymph nodes. As lymph is traveling back to the heart through lymphatic vessels, it's filtered by lymph nodes. It's filtered for bacteria and things that don't belong in your body. And tonsils, that's another filtering organ. It helps identify pathogens. Right? The spleen helps identify pathogens. And the thymus gland is also a lymphatic gland. There's a special kind of lymphocyte that goes to the thymus gland to mature, to gain competence, right? They become active in order to help fight infection. It's a lymphocyte, but it's a special kind of lymphocyte, and it's called a T lymphocyte because it matures in the thymus gland, T lymphocyte. And another thing, so there's a nice T in thymus, there's a T in T lymphocyte, and the function of this kind of lymphocyte is special. There are other kind of lymphocytes. A T lymphocyte is a contact killer. It has to bump into a bacteria before it can kill it. It's a contact killer. So a lot of T's in contact, right? So thymus, T lymphocyte, contact killer. So maybe you can kind of just match that all up in your mind. So where are these different organs at? Well, I think this is a pretty good illustration of lymphatic system. Okay, yeah, I like the first one. Here's some lymphatic system. Here I see some vessels. What are these vessels called? Lymph vessels, right? Just lymphatic vessels. And as lymph goes back to the heart, it's got to pass through these little jobby things right here. What are these? These are lymph nodes. And notice that as lymph goes back to the heart, it always goes through at least one lymph node. Sometimes many, but at least one. Okay, and well, we were looking at some other organs. Okay, so lymph vessels, lymph nodes. What kind of fluid is in this lymphatic vessel? Yeah, lymph, which is a lot like plasma, right? So there shouldn't be any red blood cells. And there, where are some other organs? I don't see much in the way of other organs. I just see, spleen. Here I see spleen. Thymus gland would be about in this region right here. What else do we have? Tonsils, which are going to be in the oral and nasal cavity, which we can't see. But fortunately, I do see a spleen. Okay. All right, well, let's talk a little bit more about this network of blood vessels. How does lymph get into a lymphatic vessel? Okay, so let's take a look at this picture right here. So here is the whole cardiovascular system, right? Here's the heart, and this is what? The systemic circulation. So here's the aorta, artery bringing blood to a systemic capillary. And in that systemic capillary, remember, they're kind of leaky. So not only can material like oxygen diffuse out, but some plasma can actually leak out through the fenestrations and intercellular clefts. So on the proximal end of the capillary, a lot of fluid leaves. Right? And on the distal end, some of that fluid is resorbed back into the cardiovascular system, but not all of it. Right? So how much is left in the spaces? 30 liters of plasma pass out of your capillaries every day. 30 liters. Wow, how many liters is 30 liters? What is this right here, this little Coke bottle? That's maybe a half a liter. Doesn't say. Oh, 500 ml. Here's half a liter. So how much fluid leaks out of your body? 60 of these things every day, right? Nourishing all the tissues that leak out of your systemic circulation, right? And then some of that gets resorbed, because what would happen to you if all of a sudden this 30 liters stayed in your tissue spaces and then get put back in the blood? Could you imagine being not 30 liters bigger, 60 of these things bigger every day, right? You'd just swell up. Some of that is resorbed. 27 liters gets put back on this distal part of the capillary, but 3 liters remain in the tissue spaces, even with a normal individual. So there would be 6 of these things in your body every single day stuck, right? So you'd be 6 liters bigger one day, right? Then another, and another, and another, or 6 of these bottles, 3 liters. You would swell up. So the job of the lymphatic system is to take that excess tissue fluid that didn't get resorbed in the distal end of this capillary and return it back to the cardiovascular system. And when it's returned, what does that do to the swelling that takes place? Yeah, it alleviates that swelling. That swelling is what we call edema, right? So the lymphatic system is really important for fighting edema in your body so that you don't swell up. So if you got bigger, 3 liters every day, bigger and bigger day after day after day, eventually you would just blow up and there'd just be a big pile of lymph laying around someplace. Right? So lymphatic system is super important. Right, so how does that tissue fluid get into a lymph vessel? Well, there's a lymph capillary, and it's a lot like a regular capillary. It's a very thin-walled tube. So let's take a look at this expanded region. On the right-hand side of this slide, I can see an arteriole bringing blood to a capillary. Here is the proximal end. A lot of fluid is leaking out. Here's the network. Here's the distal end. Some of the fluid is resorbed. Then here's the vein taking it back to the heart. So 3 liters a day remain in these tissue spaces, and these lymph capillaries collect it and start to drain it back toward the heart. So this is where that excess tissue fluid gets resorbed in this network. So here is, right, a capillary, a lymphatic capillary. And you can see it's a dead-end tube. It's not like a regular vascular capillary because there's nothing feeding it. This is just the origin of the vascular system, and tissue fluid enters this lymph capillary, and then it becomes lymph, travels back to a subclavian vein. So I think the next picture is a zoomed-in region of the beginning, the origin of a lymphatic capillary. So here is the origin of a lymphatic capillary. Here's a nice endothelium that makes up the wall of that lymph capillary. And then here is what we call a mini valve. These things can open and close, and when they open, tissue fluid enters. And right when that fluid tries to leave, it can't because it only allows the entry of tissue fluid into this capillary. And then it makes its way back to the heart. All right, so the pressure inside this lymph capillary is very much like a vein. Did we talk about how venous blood returns to the heart? How does blood and veins return to the heart? You need pressure in order for blood to move from one place to another, and there's almost no pressure in a vein. And the way that blood returns to the heart is because, I think we talked about this, You have, yes, you have the skeletal muscle pump and you have the respiratory pump. Whenever you contract a muscle, it squeezes down on a vein and blood is going to want to squirt toward the heart or back down to the periphery, but it can't squirt back down to the periphery because veins have valves, right? They can only squirt back to the heart. Same thing for lymphatic vessels, right? When a muscle contracts, it's going to pressurize this fluid and it's going to want to squirt toward the heart or away from the heart, but it can't because it has valves as well. So where is a valve? Well, here is just an illustration, okay, of a valve right here. And it looks very much like a valve that you have in a vein, right? So when this area here is pressurized, the valve allows it to flow in this direction. But if this area here is pressurized, this valve prevents the retrograde flow of lymph. And so it can only go back to the heart. So here are valves, and here's a lymph node. Okay, so I don't see any valves. So now we know some cardiovascular structures that have valves. Let's list what they are. Okay, give me an example of a cardiovascular structure that has a valve. A heart, that's right. How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
It's got four, that's great. Okay. Besides the heart, what else has a valve? A vein has a valve. And then there's one more. Lymphatic vessels have valves. And they're very, very similar to the valves in veins. Okay. So that's what helps maintain lymphatic flow back to the heart. So we were talking about these lymphatic vessels here. Begins within lymph capillaries. That's just some leftover plasma or interstitial fluid or space between cells. Lymph capillaries join together to form vein-like lymphatic vessels. This is true. Okay, so I can see these things here. Lymph vessels contain valves to prevent retrograde flow. All right, and so what moves lymph back to the heart? That skeletal muscle pump. Pressure changes in the thorax, sometimes we call that the respiratory pump. So when you increase the volume of your thorax, okay, when you increase the volume of your thorax and you have your mouth open or your nose open, what happens to air? Goes in, right? Can you feel that air going in like that? So your chest actually becomes like a vacuum cleaner, right? Air is rushing into your lungs. You can feel that going. So not only does air rush into your thoracic cavity, but any kind of fluid that has an opportunity would, including blood that's in veins and lymph that's in lymphatic vessels, because your thorax is acting like a vacuum, okay, when you breathe, when you contract your diaphragm. So that's what we call the respiratory pump. Here's something that's a little bit different. Right? There are smooth muscles and lymphatic vessels that contract. And that also can propel lymph back to the heart. That is something that we don't see in veins. Veins don't have that. This is kind of similar to your digestive tract, where you have smooth muscles that work moving, digesting material through your digestive tract. Lymphatic vessels have that as well. So they have three things. Veins only have two, right? The skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump. A lot of times in this class, we look at things in your body and notice that your body is very symmetrical. What you have on the right, you have on the left. Like if you have a thumb on the left, what do you got on the right? You got a thumb, right? Okay, you got a gonad on the right, you got a gonad on the left, right? Nice bilateral symmetry. If you got an iliac artery on the right, you got one on the left. We call that bilateral symmetry. That symmetry is really disturbed in the lymphatic system. And let's take a look and see why that is. All right, so here we have a man, and I can see that the background color, the shaded region of this man, is not the same everywhere in the body. How many colors do you see? I see basically two. All right, and it's not completely defined by the mid-sagittal plane. I see like a yellow color. Okay, go ahead and tell me. Yellow?
Green.
Green. Light green, almost like yellow. This light green color, right, is shading the right side of the head, right, the right thorax, and the right upper appendage, but not the right abdominal region, pelvic region, or the right lower limb. Right, so there is a vessel that drains blood from the right side of the body, but only the head, thorax, and limb. Right, and okay, and I can see the jugular vein, right? And I can see a subclavian vein. Okay, and the vessel that brings this lymph from these areas back to the circulatory system is called the right lymphatic duct. Right lymphatic duct. So that doesn't seem too special. What about the left side of the body and the left abdomen and pelvis and left lower appendage? Lymph drains, right, in a common pathway back to the left subclavian vein via the thoracic duct. So there's nothing that is similar on the right side of the body. The thoracic duct drains blood from the whole left side of the body and the lower parts of the right side of the body. And at the very entrance to the thoracic duct, there's a little collecting basin called the cisterna chyli. Right, here's a thoracic duct going all the way to a subclavian vein. So that lymph then joins the circulatory system. Now, there can be a lot of junk in that lymph as it goes back to the circulatory system. There could be bacteria, right, fungi, and things like that. Do you think that's a good idea to take all those bacteria from the extremities and put it back into a blood vessel that's really close to your heart? Bad idea. So, and the lymphatic system doesn't do that because what does the lymphatic system have? It has filters all along the way, and those filters are called lymph nodes, right? And those lymph nodes are an important part of your immune system. They can recognize bacteria, and then they can try to figure out a way to kill those bacteria by activating different kinds of systems, like maybe T lymphocytes or B lymphocytes or other kinds of things. Okay. All right, so what is one of the major functions of your lymphatic vessels? Let's talk about that for a second. What are these lymphatic vessels doing? They're taking excess tissue fluid, say in this extremity, and returning it to your cardiovascular system so that this extremity here doesn't swell up. We call that edema, right? So it doesn't swell up. Well, if somebody has cancer in some part of their body, sometimes those cancer cells will migrate into the lymphatic system, and guess where they have a tendency to end up? In lymph nodes, because that's the job of a lymph node, right? To filter things that don't belong in blood. Cells really don't belong, I mean, in lymph. Cells don't belong in lymph. So cancer cells can accumulate in these lymph nodes, and then they can migrate to even other parts of the body. So for instance, if somebody has breast cancer, right, the cancer is removed, but also these lymph nodes have to be removed and maybe even analyze some pathology on them right away to see if there is cancer in these lymph nodes. If there is, then some more lymph nodes, a little bit more distal in that pattern, have to be removed. All right, so cancer has a tendency to move through the lymphatic system, and these lymph vessels and nodes are removed from that part of the body that has a tumor growing. Well, what's the side effect? For instance, if all of these lymphatic vessels are removed, okay, what happens to this part of the body? It swells up. That's right. So edema certainly is one of the side effects of removing these lymph nodes and lymphatic vessels. But I guess, what would you rather have? Some edema in some part of your body or a metastatic cancer? Well then, right, it's much better to have some kind of edema, and maybe over time, right, that can be dealt with. All right, so that's one of the major functions of your lymphatic system and maybe some side effects. Let me go back up here. Okay, some other functions of the lymphatic system. We said maintaining fluid balance, right, preventing edema, that's one. When we have lipids in our diet, when we eat fat and lipid is the same thing, it doesn't enter our circulatory system. So let's think about the three major classes of compounds that we eat, important biological compounds that we consume. I heard proteins, I like that. I said fat is one. So I got proteins, fat, and then let's consider a third one. I think I heard carbohydrates. Sugar and carbohydrates. So you got proteins, carbohydrates, and lipids. Okay? If you take some sugar and put it in a glass of water, will it dissolve in that water? Yeah, very easily, right? So carbohydrates can be transported by the blood because blood is basically water. Amino acids, which are the building block of proteins, they can dissolve in water as well, right? So they can be absorbed from your small intestine and put into the blood, and they can travel through your body very nicely because they dissolve in the water that's in your blood, the plasma, the water component. Now, what about oils, lipids, and fats? Do they dissolve in water? They do not, right? So your body doesn't absorb lipids and fats and put them directly in the blood. They are absorbed by the lymphatic system and processed first so that they can be transported in the blood. So that's another important function of the lymphatic system, fat absorption from the gastrointestinal tract, not a regular systemic capillary. And that vessel, that lymphatic vessel, that lymphatic capillary in the small intestine that absorbs lipids is called a lacteal. And I'm gonna show you a picture of that when we get into the digestive system, and not right now. It's in the small intestine. And when lymph is mixed with fat, it becomes a milky white fluid that we call chyle. And it's processed, right? And then after it's processed, it's put into your cardiovascular system. The other function, our last function, is for the lymphatic system. So not only maintaining fluid, absorbing fat, it's part of your immune system, body self-defense system. We said that lymph nodes filter lymph. Okay. The spleen also filters, but it filters blood. So, but a lymph node and a spleen are sort of similar because they contain lymphocytes. Remember, lymphocytes can fight infection. So a lymph node filters lymph, spleen filters blood. They contain lymphocytes, both to fight infection. So that's why the spleen is part of the lymphatic system. And here is another pretty good picture. Okay, so here are some lymphatic organs. Here's that spleen. Here's the thymus gland. What cavity is that thymus gland in? Okay, thoracic. That's pretty good. Think smaller. Mediastinum. Yeah, mediastinum. That's excellent. Mediastinum. That's the best way to think of it. Okay, and then here are your tonsils. So we have two pairs of tonsils and then a third one. These fight infection for bacteria that are trying to get into your body from your nasal cavity or oral cavity, right? And so they can contain lymphocytes. And where else do we see some lymphatic tissue? Ah, here's an appendix. We haven't looked at the digestive system just yet, but here's the appendix. And it also is some lymphatic tissue that fights infection, because inside our intestine, we have just billions and billions and billions of bacteria, and usually they're helpful bacteria. They help produce vitamins for us, but we don't want those bacteria leaving the intestine and infecting other parts of our body. So the appendix is there to make sure that that happens, and that only relatively non-pathogenic bacteria are inside your intestines. But you also see some other lymphatic tissue. Okay, and we're going to call these aggregated lymphoid nodules. These are on the outside of your intestines, and again, they help fight infection. They help prevent those bacteria that are in your intestines from entering your body. But there's also something else. Everywhere within the small intestine, large intestine, and the stomach, there is lymphatic tissue, right, that can fight infection within the wall of the intestine. And that's what we call mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT. And MALT is lymphoid tissue with some connective tissue, mostly reticular, and it contains vast quantities of lymphocytes. And what do lymphocytes do? They fight infection. This MALT is found in mucous membranes of your digestive tract. And is your digestive tract, is it lined with a mucous membrane or a serous membrane? I maybe hear somebody offering an opinion, but not really loud. Okay, mucus or serous? What does a serous membrane line? It lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world. A mucous membrane lines a cavity that is open to the outside world. Is your digestive tract open to the outside world? Yeah, otherwise you would starve to death, right, if you had no way of putting food in there, right? So it is open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane lines the digestive tract? It is a mucous membrane. And in that mucous membrane, it contains that lymphatic tissue all over the place, that lymphatic tissue we call malt, right? So the digestive system has it. What about respiratory system? Are your respiratory passageways open to the outside world? Yeah, because otherwise you never get air in your lungs. Urinary system, is your urinary system open to the outside world? Yes, otherwise you'd never be able to get rid of urine, right? Reproductive tracts, are they open to the outside world? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so they contain malt, which is lymphatic tissue, which can identify bacteria, and when they identify bacteria, they become activated, right? And that activation happens in what we call germinal centers. So there can be white blood cells that divide, right? So you might have one, and then two, and then four, and then six. We call that proliferation, when those lymphatic cells multiply to fight infection. We call that immune system activation. And immune system activation happens in germinal centers. So germinal centers are found in malt, but they're also in what? The appendix, the spleen, the thymus, and lymph nodes all over your body can become activated when there are pathogens there. So I typically get a question about this spleen and even this appendix. An appendix can be inflamed, can be infected, and it's sort of ironic because it's there to fight infection, but it can be so inflamed that it swells up and then it bursts open, right? That causes a peritonitis, usually not fatal, but I'm sure a person feels like they're going to die when that happens, right? It's best to remove it before it bursts open. Okay, and it's removed, so that part of the lymphatic system is removed. Sometimes when somebody's in a traumatic accident, the spleen gets damaged. And remember, what kind of connective tissue holds the spleen together? What kind of fibers? Reticular fibers, and they're what? Strong or weak or what? Really weak, right? So trauma can rip the spleen apart, and there's no way to sew it back together because reticular fibers aren't strong enough. So spleen has to be removed, or part of the spleen, or most of it, depending on the nature of that injury. All right, so now the spleen is removed, so you're missing that lymphatic organ. So I typically get questions, well, what happens? Oh, and as a matter of fact, sometimes people get a chronically infected tonsil. And over years of time, you realize the only way to treat that is to remove those tonsils. What do we call that when somebody removes tonsils? Tonsillectomy, right. Okay, so there are various lymphatic organs, like your tonsils, your spleen, your appendix, that can be removed surgically. The question I get a lot of times is, well, what happens to your immune system, your immune response, when some of these important immune organs are removed from your body? Are you more susceptible to infection when that happens? So that's interesting to think of that. Okay, and here's the answer. You have so much other lymphatic tissue everywhere in your body in the form of malt and other lymphatic organs that usually, right, somebody is not more susceptible to infection. Because you have so much lymphatic tissue, so many of these little armies that are fighting infection, that it's not a problem. Only in certain circumstances, and that is when you have surgery. What's one of the possible side effects? There's a risk of having surgery, and it is infection, right? And so somebody might be a little bit more prone to infection due to a surgery. There's one kind of surgery that there's a high incidence of infection as a result of it, and that is when someone has a prosthesis placed in their body, maybe a metallic clip to prevent a blood vessel from bleeding, or maybe a prosthetic hip, right, or prosthetic knee, then there's a really high incidence of infection as a result of those surgeries. So if somebody is missing a spleen and they elect to have hip surgery, they have to consider and be really careful of infection. Right, that's pretty much the only case, but that's pretty extreme when you start to replace your joints like that, right? But so usually it's really not any problem whatsoever. Okay, because why? You have lymphatic tissue all over the place fighting infection. Okay, well, I think I just need to finish up a couple things. Next time I want to talk about the tonsils and some lymph nodes a little bit, and the thymus and spleen. That should maybe take about 10 minutes or so, and then we're going to move on to the next chapter. I'm not sure I know what the next chapter is. Maybe respiratory system. Good. Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And then you all maybe get to the digestive system next week. That is really a fun system to look at because it is so disgusting. But it's fun to talk about. Thank you.